What's up, Wisconsin? I'm Maggie Dawn. He's Brian Kelly. You're listening to the Civic Media Radio Network. Really excited. It is 3 o'clock, so that means it is Maggie and the Millionaires talking money. Can't wait to get to that. But I got to share with you some breaking news just within the last few minutes. We have gotten word that a day after the state Supreme Court has dismissed a challenge to remove Green Party candidate Jill Stein from the ballot in Wisconsin, the bipartisan Wisconsin Elections Commission confirmed that she will appear on November ballots in the battleground state. There were basically two different processes going on. The reporting continues. The commission on Tuesday also kept independent candidate Robert F. Kennedy Jr. on the ballot, even though he has suspended his presidential campaign. The Wisconsin election commissioners also approved independent candidate Cornell West for the ballot after rejecting a challenge that argued his declarations of candidacy were not properly filed due to notarization issues. Really interesting developments. So basically, the full panoply of third-party candidates will be on the ballot in Wisconsin. You heard it here first. And without any further ado, I want to welcome Scott Ellis, who is an alumni of the most elite institutions in the country, we should say, Scott. Harvard, Stanford, McKinsey, the largest consulting firm in the world, and, of course, Silicon Valley. You wouldn't be an elite if you didn't spend some time in Silicon Valley and Palo Alto. This is what I think is really incredible here, Scott. You're like the rich white dude, like the example of this. And yet, you have been thinking and writing and telling everybody who will listen that Americans, that we think about and have gotten this whole concept of wealth all wrong. And that basically wealthy people need to, and we're going to find what that means because that's really important, that these really wealthy people need to admit they've got plenty, that they've got more than enough, and that we need a better approach. That's where we're at, right, Scott? I mean, this is your fundamental viewpoint. You call it the excessive wealth disorder. You founded an institute in its name. Tell us what that is.
Absolutely. So you are right, Maggie. And no, I am not crazy. I do mean these things. Yeah, a few years ago, I worked with a colleague, Alan Davis, and founded a nonprofit called the Excessive Wealth Disorder Institute. And the reason is that we think we need to transform how our society thinks and talks about wealth and wealth inequality, and especially excessive wealth. A lot of folks are working on things like universal basic income and other ways to help support those who don't have enough, which is so critical, so important. And of course, I absolutely support all those efforts, but not enough of us are talking about the other end of the spectrum. And we hear about it in the news a lot, and we read about billionaires going to space and people giving hundreds of millions of dollars to political campaigns, and then we kind of nod our heads and move on to the next thing. And I'm saying, wait, this is the most important foundational root cause of so many of the problems facing our society. And so we need to talk about wealth. We need to talk accurately about it. What is it? How much do people have? How much do wealthy people have? Recognize that, frankly, our brains can't really grasp the difference between hundreds of thousands or billions, and then talk about how much enough is and what to do about it.
You've actually come up with like the number. Like, this is, after this point, it's basically the wealthy person or family is getting, we talked about this a little bit yesterday, no marginal return. Like, there's actually no benefit. There's no more stuff you can buy. Like, you've got plenty. You've figured out what that number is, when enough is enough. How do you define that, and how'd you get there? Because that's fascinating.
Yeah, I have Scott's proposal. Absolutely. And I think the most important thing for all of us is for all of us to think and talk about this and to answer the question, but we should not be answering it for ourselves. This is not an individual question. It's, what do we want the rule to be for our society? We're all here in this democracy. We're here in this capitalist economy. We should figure out the rules. And I think one of the most important rules that you should have is, what's the goal? And so we should start by saying, what is financial success? So often people talk about wealth taxes or extreme wealth, et cetera, but it's a little bit in a vacuum, or it's based on how much money people have today. I think we should start from a different place. I've got a daughter who recently graduated college. I've got friends, people who are just starting out, and we should say, what is financial success? And I would say, first, if you're financially successful, it means you never have to work again. Congratulations, you won capitalism. We'll give you a trophy, you won, never have to work again. You have a really nice first house, probably have a really nice second house. You've got nice cars, your kids' college is all paid for, your end of life expenses are covered, you can take nice vacations, and you have a very comfortable ongoing existence. And if you do the math with reasonable assumptions about inflation and investment returns, if you're what, late 40s, you know, 50s, you know, kind of where, hey, I've been successful. If you have $30 million, you can get all those things, right? You can do that math. And so I think what I would really encourage people to say is, first of all, think about this for yourself. You know, what would financial success look like? And then we should decide, in a society where 10% of people have no wealth at all, right? We've got people living in poverty. The median household has $190,000. And for these conversations, one thing we should do is I'll use a common unit of measure. Let's talk in millions. So the median household has 0.19, which means 50% of households have less than that. Almost nobody ever gets to $1 million. It's very rare. So 30 million is incredibly successful. So let's define that as enough. And then my argument would be, if that's enough, then nobody should have more than that. Because once people have more than that, it's excessive wealth. And as you say, people can't buy more things to make their lives better. They can buy power, and they use it to undermine our political system by influencing campaigns, and they undermine our capitalist economy by distorting markets, and that hurts all of us.
It's your definition, this approach, it reminds me a wee little bit of this childhood game that we all played, literally a game called life, where if you hit the right squares at the right time, you'll end up in the end. And most of the time, if I remember correctly, that game was like a runaway, right? Because if you got the right college degree, you went to the right place, you got the right job, you were all set. And certainly, Scott, 1 to 2 homes, whatever cars you want, all of your end of life planning for you and your spouse, your kids' college paid for, they may be set up, maybe give them a little seed money for their first business. All that can be done with $30 million. I'm sorry, what more? What more is it fair to ask for? I think is that another way to put what you're saying?
Well, it's interesting to me because I talk to people about this idea, and so many people say, "Yeah, that makes sense." And if you want to quibble, right? Some people say $30 million—that's way too much. I don't need that much. In which case, I'd say, "Great, you're definitely on board, right?" And then some people may say, "Oh, maybe it needs to be 40." But I'm like, "Fine,
right?"
But the real issue is, and this is where it comes back to talking clearly about money and talking accurately. And when we talk about excessive wealth disorder, you know, quickly people say, oh, that's just rich people, right? They have so much money, but no matter what, they always want more. The more important part of excessive wealth disorder for me is all the rest of us, because we're very worried about things like, you know, the 8 percentage point gender pay gap, which is really important, or the racial wage gap, which is huge. But then we're not at all worried when I say, oh, someone's got 100,000 times more money than you do, and it's fine. And I think that's what we need to say. Let's stop using the word billionaire, because a billionaire is a 1,000 millionaire. Mm. And so if we're saying half of all households have 0.19 or less.
Millions, I'm saying, millions, just so people.
Millions, 0.19 millions.
Or 190,000 or less in wealth. Sorry to interrupt.
There
just want people to
and
catch
then
it.
We're saying, what if I say success is 30 million, which is 150 times the median? That's a lot of inequality. There's a lot of opportunity for innovation and encouragement for a better life. Why do we have someone who's got, say, $10 billion, which is 10,000 million, when we're saying, why does anybody need more than 30? Well, that guy's got 10,000. And the rest of us are saying, okay. Like, we shouldn't be saying, okay. We should say, no, this is unacceptable and we need to fix it.
How do you square this with capitalism? Like, I can imagine a lot of people listening saying, well, that's not capitalism. If you're capping how much someone can earn, isn't the whole point of capitalism that you can get as much stuff and earn as much as you want? And that's the whole point. And we're profit maximizing into infinity. Are you anti-wealth? Are you anti-capitalism?
Well, I think you said some of the magic words is Does it have to be into infinity? Is it either it is completely unrestricted or it's not capitalism at all? And I would say, I just don't think that's true. I think capitalism a lot is actually like nuclear power, right? It's very powerful, very efficient, all these things. But if you don't put in the control rods to manage it, the entire thing melts down. And I think that's what's happening with capitalism today. And in some ways, this is not new. We saw it over 100 years ago with John D. Rockefeller and Andrew Carnegie and the robber barons. We've seen this before. And I think the key premises are, do we want fair market competition? Do we want buyers and sellers with free information making voluntary exchanges? That's what capitalism's about. Do we want people to have incentive and opportunity to create new businesses and innovate and create jobs? Outstanding. Is it really true that people say, well, if you tell me I'll start this company and I never have to work again, I have 30 million, I have multiple houses, that's not enough and I won't start it, because unless I get to infinity, and I'd say, I think that's part of excessive wealth disorder, where we are all saying, if you limit it at all, it won't work. I think that's simply false. But this is a story that we, if you will, regular people, have been told by the very, very wealthy to say, let's not talk about wealth at all. Let's not pay attention to it. You absolutely shouldn't look at restricting what I'm doing, because I think this is false, because we are offering tons of upside for people, which is never have to work again, have multiple houses. What a wonderful life. I think this is the future we should be shooting for.
That is Scott Ellis, Harvard, Stanford, McKinsey, and Silicon Valley alumni, a rich guy himself, that's saying we got a problem with wealth in this country. We're not talking about it correctly. We haven't defined it correctly. And it is not a choice between infinite wealth and no limits at all and socialism. That is a false choice. We'll talk more about it when we get back. Super excited to have Scott with me. I'm Maggie Dawn. This is the Civic Media Radio Network. You're listening to Maggie and the Millionaires talking money in the 3 o'clock hour. Don't go anywhere. We'll be right back with Scott after these important messages.
You are so money and you don't even know it.
Welcome back, Wisconsin. I'm Maggie Dawn. You're listening to the Civic Media Radio Network. It is the first half of the 3 o'clock hour, so it is Maggie and the Millionaires talking money. The very smart millionaire I've got with me today is Scott Ellis. He went to Harvard and Stanford. He worked at McKinsey, the largest consulting firm in the world. Worked in Silicon Valley. Guy knows what he's talking about. And what we're exploring, Scott, is this fundamental idea that there is a limit to productive wealth, if that's an okay way for me to put it. And please correct me. And meaning wealth that's serving a productive purpose, that you've cared for your kids and they're going to be just fine, that you have plenty to see you through retirement in all of the luxurious comforts that one could envision and your spouse is too, that everything is just okay and you don't have to work anymore. Funny, Scott, because about a decade ago when I was in grad school for economics, I was making this argument, not as eloquently as you. And people would make the same counter argument to me. Well, it's not 30 million, it's 40 million. And I would respond and say, well, then pick the number. But there is a number after which the money really doesn't have much value at all to that rich, incredibly wealthy person. They have everything that could possibly be wanted by a human being. And so I think it's important. Your analysis goes a bit further and you suggest that what people end up buying is power and political access and basically the means by which to control the system. Are we at this tipping point, Scott? Is that why this is so very important to you and others?
No, I think we absolutely are. I think there's one issue, which is, are we worried about wealthy folks having money because, you know, there's a lot of research showing that after some point, money doesn't increase your happiness. Yeah. And are we worried about that? And for me, that's not my main concern. And I don't think it's the reason we all should be talking about it. I'm worried because I love my country and I'm worried about the state of our democracy and the state of our capitalist economy. And I think that's what for all of us, it really should be about is that. And then our own individual lives and how do we pursue better lives for ourselves? How do we make sure that our voices are heard in the electoral system? And the issue is that once you get enough wealth and you run out of things to buy that make your daily life better, it's almost like a chemical equation where money becomes power. And right. So you may not care how much money someone else has, but you probably care how much power someone else has. And when we talk about a lot of the things that are being discussed now in these coming months in the political election here, but stepping back and looking at where the country's been over the last, say, 40 years, you know, the measures of inequality are showing nothing but increasing inequality. But I think the thing we're not talking about enough is the extreme concentration of wealth, which really means extreme concentration of power in the hands of very few individuals. And when that happens, they control things like buying massive media and other communications vehicles. They influence political campaigns. And when they do, the fact that, you know, you and I and all of our viewers, all of our listeners, we each get one vote. And so do the wealthy individuals. But if they're giving $165 million to a political system paying $2,000, I don't believe my voice is going to be heard. And so it's really about that issue of excess wealth becoming power and how that's used.
Well, in power, I think we're all familiar with the phrase, you know, power corrupts perfectly, right? The more power you accumulate, it becomes really, really difficult to I think, observe some guardrails. If your reach is limitless, okay,
I
mean, then.
I think a lot about, you know, the sort of issue, you know, power corrupts, absolute power corrupts, absolutely.
Right.
And what I think about a lot is when people get excessive wealth, what happens to them as individuals? The first is there's a lack of empathy. And it's not because they're mean or intentional. It's just our lives become so different that they don't know what we're talking about when I say I want to pay for taxes to fill the potholes. Like, well, yeah. I took the helicopter. What are you talking about? There's a lack of empathy. There's a pursuit of elitism for its own sake, right? The reason I'm doing this is because I'm in the club and you're not. And, you know, Dr. Seuss had his book where, like, do you have a star on your belly? Well, people want to have stars on their belly and they use wealth to do that. So the pursuit of elitism. And then the last is just greed. And we're all human. And I would also say, you know, we're the top predator. That's what humans are. That's how we took over the planet. This is what we do. And that's great in times of scarcity because that's how predators survive. But now we're in an era of abundance. There is so much wealth, but we're not acting like it. Because we're the top predators. And so this lack of empathy and pursuit of elitism and greed are things that lead, you know, and I'm not saying they're bad people, but they're people who, again, are accumulating massive power. And as we know, power corrupts. And I think I would trust each of us to vote and each of us to run our economic lives in a fair system. And I'm worried that that's at risk because of extreme wealth.
Can I simplify this greatly, Scott? I've been jotting notes down furiously as you're
great.
Speaking. And what's sort of coalescing in my mind is a version of I've been saying for a while, hey, to save our democracy right now, we have the only thing that will save our democracy is democracy. A version of that here, to save capitalism, if you're a capitalist, we need to stop this level of acute wealth inequality, that we have to limit absolutely scaled wealth, you know, the Elon Musk level wealth. Something has to be done there. And we can start there. And it's urgent. But to save capitalism, we have to face down wealth inequality in this country. Is it a fair way
to
put
it? Yeah, I would say we have to save capitalism from itself.
Yes.
And the way we do it is by just managing excessive wealth. Right. We have highway systems that are great. We put speed limits. It's OK. Right. You have nuclear reactors. We put in the control rods. It's OK. We can harness this power. Same thing with capitalism. What we really want is capitalism. What we don't want is hyper capitalism. And that's where we are now. So I think we need to manage excessive wealth to enable capitalism to do what it's supposed to do, which is to enable us all to thrive.
My guest this half hour, and Scott, I'm going to impose upon you. Do you have a few more minutes to spare with us? I do.
I'm happy to talk more.
Wonderful, because this is the thing. My special guest this half hour, and for some extra bonus minutes, is Scott Ellis. He's a Harvard and Stanford alumni, worked at McKinsey, worked in Silicon Valley. He himself is extremely wealthy and successful, and he's telling us we got to do something about this, that extraordinary wealth is a threat to capitalism, and by extension, it is also a threat to our democracy. You're not going to go anywhere. Our wonderful discussion with Scott is going to continue after this. I'm going to cue up what I want to talk about next. We've been thinking about this hyper-capitalism and the way that the discussion and the framework, I think, for regular folks has been manipulated a bit, right? Because it seems that we happen to have this all or nothing discussion, Scott, and you've been making some incredibly important points about the nuance, about it's not all or nothing, these reject the false choice. So I want to start with that when we come back. You have been sold a bill of goods, everybody. There is a false choice that's been presented to you. It's about time we dig in and reject that false choice for what is better for all of us and our country. I'm Maggie Dawn. Again, my special guest this half hour, and for some bonus time, is Scott Ellis. It is Maggie and the Millionaires Talking Money. We're going to be back in just a few minutes here on the Civic Media Radio Network. Don't go anywhere.
Maybe we could launder them.
Some say money is bad for the soul, bad for the rock, bad for the roll, bad for the heart, bad for the brain, bad for yeah, everything. Oh, yeah!
Money bad for the soul? My guest thinks so, at least after you hit the 30 million mark. I'm joined this hour by Scott Ellis, a rich guy that has started an institute called the Excessive Wealth Disorder Institute. Welcome back, Scott. Thank you so much. We've been talking about the fact that Americans have been, I think, kind of duped, snake oil salesmen, into thinking that there is one of two extreme options, that we're either talking about like communism and socialism if we propose taxing wealthy people a lot, or, as I talked about back in grad school, at 100% past a certain level, that's communism and socialism. And at the other side is you got to have super low taxes on corporations and billionaires, and that's the only capitalistic way to go about doing things. Is that a fair summary of your view of how this discussion has been posed to American voters? And if not, correct it. And if it is, or what how you want to place that dichotomy, why is that so wrong? Why is that not actually the choice that American voters have?
Yeah, I do think it's frankly part of a very intentional strategy, because at the Excessive Wealth Disorder Institute, one of the things we talk about is the cycle of excessive wealth, right? You've got to accumulate the wealth in the first place. And it's really hard to accumulate massive wealth. I mean, if you think about it, you've either got to be born into it, you've got to get really lucky, or you've got to be really exploiting people or the planet or the political system. So you've got to accumulate it, but then you've got to hoard it. And a key part of that is defending the wealth. And so one of my colleagues, Chuck Harris, who runs inequality.org, has written a book that's about the wealth defense industry. And so wealthy folks don't do this on their own. They hire an army of lawyers and consulting firms and others to figure out how to hide their wealth, to move it, to avoid paying taxes on it. And a key part of this is to make sure that regular people don't talk about it. And if we do, we don't really know what wealth they have. And if they do, we don't really get it. And we're certainly not going to actively advocate for actions to address it. And so I think it is absolutely a key part of the strategy, because otherwise, how does a very, very small number of extremely wealthy people preserve their wealth in a democracy. They're going to lose the election 99.5 to 0.5. So you have to distract, you have to obscure. And I think that's a lot of what's happening. And I think it really is a false choice, because it's funny. I live in Silicon Valley. I know a lot of innovators. I know a lot of people with new ideas, and they don't say, I have this amazing idea that I really think could work, but I'm only going to do it if I can make $1 billion. If you tell me I make enough to never have to work again, that's not what happens.
Yeah.
Right. They want to try their idea. They want to see if it works. And if it does, fantastic. Now, once they get very wealthy, they may start having a different point of view. And this is where excessive wealth disorder kicks in. All of a sudden, oh my gosh, I need more, et cetera. But the other thing I think is interesting is that people who want to innovate, they love innovating.
Yes.
I know the one person, they invented this cool backyard pinwheel for people's gardens, which are beautiful. And then they invented this new crocodile themed ski suit. And then they invented this container that enables you to convert jugs from different, and that's what they do. And so if you say, oh, but if you do this, they're just going to stop innovating. No, I don't think that's true. And then the other piece is people say, well, but if these really powerful people, then they're going to stop helping us. I'd say, well, how sure are we that they're actually helping us? I mean, what I would basically say to folks is there are wealthy people who do wonderful things with their money. They're doing philanthropy. They're contributing to society. That's fantastic. My question would be, I don't care about the first $30 million. Do whatever you want with it. But I kind of need a full accounting of all the rest. So I'm glad you're doing some good stuff with the philanthropy, but what are you doing with the rest of it? And you know, I've got one story of this organization. It was a big finance firm, had a nonprofit arm, and there was this thing in Los Angeles with the low housing thing. And so they were going to put in $1 million, and they were trying to find four other foundations to help them so they could get $5 million to address this substandard housing issue. But it turns out that the key reason the substandard housing issue happened was because they and some other funders had been actually putting, you know, $19 million into causing the problem in the first place and making money off of it. So they're paying $1 million to fix a problem they were spending $19 to cause. And so I think we need to see the full story. Are they doing some wonderful things? Great. But what are they doing with the rest? Because for us as regular citizens, if they're undermining our democracy or our capitalist economy, that matters to us and we need to know.
Yeah, the idea of noblesse oblige has been around for centuries, that meaning the obligation of the nobility to see after, in, of course, the nobility's best discretion, the regular folk. That ain't democracy, folks, right? Like, we don't live in feudalism anymore. And so your point, I think, Scott, is incredibly well taken. I think that this false choice has extended and infected all levels of our political discourse when we talk about a universal basic income, or we just try to talk about a meaningful minimum wage. I've often posited to people what I'm going to call the inverse of your calculation, Scott, which is we can figure out exactly how much it costs for a family of four in a given metropolitan statistical area for reasonable and safe housing, for food, for medical care, and maybe even to take a couple weeks vacation and educational expenses. We can know exactly what that costs within a reasonable degree of certainty. Why, my friends, ain't that the minimum wage, right? If your idea is good enough, it should be able to sustain a minimum wage that is a living minimum wage for the people that work for you. I have now digressed. I want to get back to your point, but it's kind of the flip side of that same math. I am looking at just elected officials in the state of Wisconsin. And one of our area's largest counties had a county executive that is the sole heir to a billionaire father. We currently have a senator in the state of Wisconsin whose net worth is estimated north of $40 million. We have a guy that's running for senator in the state of Wisconsin who just reported his net worth as somewhere north of $200 million, but less than about $600 million. Look, and we've got a president who claims to be a billionaire by times 10 or what have you, what nobody really knows. Is it a canary in the coal mine to look at the fact that elected offices, especially the highest in the land, have always been held by mostly wealthy people in the United States? But it seems that the people that hold these offices, that there's more of them that are the extremely wealthy. And when you look at their wealth, it is above this sort of talisman demarcation of $30 million.
Yeah. Well, I think absolutely. And the other thing to look at is how much money is being spent on political campaigns, right? In 2008, there was $5 billion spent on the congressional presidential elections, which is a huge amount of money. In 2020, it was $14 billion. So it tripled, and we're talking huge amounts of money. And so when we come back and say, what is the job that we as working people want our elected officials to do? Do we want them to spend all their time fundraising, or do we want them legislating for us? And so again, I absolutely think that the fact that the people who are in office are wealthy is a key data point, because you have to be able to afford to do it and to run and to win in the first place, but also just the sheer amount of money. And again, if we say this is supposed to be by the people, for the people, all of us, and how do we build a society where the goal is shared prosperity, where we're all prospering, right? We're all participating in this capitalist economy. We're buying and selling. We're starting businesses. And it's shared. All of us are having that happen. And all of us have a voice in that government, and a relatively equal one. And it simply can't happen if there are people who have so much excessive wealth that they can buy it.
An equal voice to have share prosperity certainly seems to be a condition precedent that has to be met. We need look no further than the U.S. Supreme Court and the decision in Citizens United to see the erosion of that, which certainly accelerated by leaps and bounds after what was a deeply misguided decision by the United States Supreme Court. What is your policy proposal or solution? Are you talking about like 100% tax after 30 million? How does this operate?
So I think as I talk to folks about this, because I do have a lot of conversations with people to say, are you worried? Do you see a problem? It seems like we can be successful. One of the key things is people don't like caps, right? We don't like caps. Again, at some point, even if people are going to be fabulously successful, we don't like caps. So my proposal is an annual 50% tax on all household wealth over $30 million. So first $30 million, we're not touching, right? So basically, your household is going to fill in an income tax form and a wealth tax form. If you have less than $30 million, nothing I'm talking about will affect you except make your life better by reducing the impact of excessive wealth. If you have over $30 million, then you will pay 50% tax on that amount.
The amount over $30 million.
Over 30. And so you can earn as much money as you want, but you do have to pay 50% tax every year. And so over time, we get to a place where the accumulated wealth does start getting whittled down and we kind of get closer to this area. And for new people, we have fewer people who actually get to a point where they have $1,000 million. And so we kind of mitigate this effect, but you can work as long as you want. You can work as hard as you want. You can earn as much money as you want, because we want that to keep happening, but we also do need to blunt the effect of excessive wealth, because we've got to save capitalism from itself.
Excessive wealth at these levels is indeed anti-democratic. Let's take a couple of questions. Phones lighting up, Scott. People really interested. L.A. Tom, say hello to Scott Ellis. What's your question or comment?
Hey, Scott. Thank you very much for your being on the show. First, would you consider the success of wealth very similar to a person that's a hoarder? Like, it's the same type of syndrome that when you walk into a person's house and have newspapers all the way up to the top of their ceiling, that it's kind of that same sickness, I guess you would say, or same condition. And then also, is there any way that you can do anything on your end to be able to fight some of these other people of excessive or morbid wealth? To get our government to go back to either the ways of FDR or Eisenhower.
So two questions from Tom, Scott. The first is the excessive wealth disorder a bit like hoarding, except you're hoarding wealth at obscene levels? And then secondly, how do we get our government to move back? How do we reinvigorate this discussion?
Yeah, I think there's an aspect of the hoarding which is similar. I mean, just the idea of protecting what you have. I think the big difference is that it's a much more aggressive action than hoarding. If someone's just hoarding, really, they're just dealing with themselves, as opposed to saying, I'm going to grow my company, which means laying off 1,000 workers because I can make more profit for myself. So it affects others. And then the bigger difference is, imagine a hoarder, but the hoarder has 1,000 houses and not just one. So one of the biggest things with excessive wealth is we all have such a hard time actually internalizing, like, how much is $10 billion, which honestly is not very wealthy in the big picture here. That's $10,000 million, which is a huge amount. So that's the big difference with the hoarders. But I think thinking along those lines, I think it's helpful. And then in terms of how we get there, honestly, I think what I'm talking about is we need to change how we're thinking about this so we can lay the groundwork for future legislative change. The real path for this eventually is changing the tax code. That is the tool that we have as citizens. And it's not going to happen tomorrow, because I expect that very few of you have heard this idea before. This is a new idea. And so we need to start talking about it. But it's a pretty straightforward idea. And if we believe this is right, then we need to start advocating for it with our legislators, because that is the path. I certainly can and am talking to my peers and colleagues about this. And again, the interesting thing for me is I get two types of reactions. Again, also from wealthy people. Oh, sorry. Either they say, hey, yeah, you're right. Things are messed up. We should do something. Pretty reasonable. Or I trigger like a crazy allergic reaction, which is, Scott, dear God, what are you talking about? You are going to destroy everything that is holy and good about America, on and on and on. So that gives me the feeling that we're on the right path.
Scott, you got just a couple more minutes. I'm going to ask you to stay with us. This is such a fascinating discussion. I think this one is for all the marbles. Pick your tortured metaphor, folks. My guest, Scott Ellis, talking about excessive wealth disorder. Don't go anywhere, folks. Jack from Merrimack, Chad from Greenfield, I see you on the lines. You'll get a chance to ask Scott your questions after these brief messages. I'm Maggie Dawn. You're listening to the Civic Media Radio Network talking about excessive wealth disorder. Does it get any sexier than this? I don't think so.
Give me some of that big fat money.
My apartment smells of rich mahogany.
Oh, I am
Wisconsin. I'm Maggie Dawn. That's Brian Kelly. You're listening to the Civic Media Radio Network. My special guest this hour started with 30 minutes, but it's so fascinating. We will talk the whole hour about it. His name's Scott Ellis. He's worked in Silicon Valley, lives there now, went to Harvard and Stanford, worked at McKinsey. He knows what he's talking about. He helped found a place called the Excessive Wealth Disorder Institute. What we're talking about is advocacy and helping legislators and elected officials start to get their heads around and for us to start to get our debates oriented around this idea that there can be a point at which wealth serves no productive purpose and is actually harming capitalism, is actually harming our democracy. Scott estimates that to be at about the $30 million level. Thanks so much for sticking around, Scott. I want to give you the chance. Your final thoughts, and also where can people find out more about the Excessive Wealth Disorder Institute? And then we'll take a couple last callers for the day. So where can people find out more, and what's your closing thought? What do you want people to take with them today?
Yeah, so you can check out the website of the Excessive Wealth Disorder Institute at excessivewealth.org. So all one word, excessivewealth.org. And you can learn about the excessive wealth cycle and all the key elements of it. And I think my closing thoughts really are, it's so important for us all, first of all, to think about wealth and talk about wealth. A lot of times in the political space, we get distracted by guns and abortion and religion and immigration and so many things. And those are all important issues. But when we're talking about well-being and the economy, we should be talking about wealth. And then we really need to focus on understanding just how big the gap is with the excessively wealthy. So if we talk in millions, the median household has 0.19. And someone who's got $100 billion has $100,000 million. And how can that possibly make sense? And I think really thinking about, for everyone to consider, how much is enough? How much is excessive? And then let's talk about it.
Thanks so much, Scott. It has been I think, revelatory for a lot of people listening. Let's take a couple of callers. Jack from Merrimack, you've been extremely patient. Thank you. Say hello to Scott. What is your question or comment?
Hello to Scott. And first question, I talk with people who are dedicated conservatives, and I ask them this simple question, which you pretty much answered, but I can't get a straight answer from them, and that is, how much is enough? Mm. And the answer I usually get is, well, they're working for it. They've earned it. And first of all, that isn't really correct. We both know that much of this wealth is inherited wealth, and people are just sitting on it and investing it. The second thing that I find is, so how do I convince people like that?
Let's just take that part, Jack. We got a couple more callers. When a conservative responds and say, well, you worked for it and they deserve it. What's the response to that, Scott?
Well, no, I think it's a really tough question, because this is part of excessive wealth disorder. Wealthy people think they earned it. They're entitled to it. They worked hard. They worked harder than others. And at some point, what I'm really talking about is, so how much is enough? Mm. And I had a friend who always said to me, how much you want is always 40% more than what you have. And I think this is a lot of what we'll see is for many of these people, there is never enough. And so I think the best thing to ask them is there no limit? Is it really true that if you had $100,000 million, it would still not be enough? And see what they say. Because if they can agree that there is an amount that's enough, now we can have a conversation, which is it 30 million? Is it 20? Is it 50? And then after that, we should start ramping it down. And so see if they actually think there's a limit at all, or whether they just refuse.
Makes me feel good, Scott and Jack, because I was asking folks this question way back in the day. There's got to be some number, right? This is how we try to dial it in. Ron from Madison, what is your question or comment for Scott? Thanks for listening.
Hey, Scott. How do you differentiate between politicians like Donald Trump or Ron Johnson, who spent a lifetime in business and then turned to public service, and politicians, for instance, Obama, who spends a lifetime in public service and comes out with $70 million, $93 million?
Great question, Ron. Scott?
I mean, in my case, although I do care at some level how the money is earned, that's not my primary concern. My primary concern is, do you have excessive wealth? If you have excessive wealth, even if you're a good person, I'm sorry, but I don't trust you. And so for me, I don't really differentiate between them. What I'm looking for is, if they have too much wealth, they're going to start accumulating too much power, and that's not good for any of us. And so I really focus on that, because often there is the argument, which is, oh, but my relative came here with nothing and worked hard and accumulated all this, and therefore it's justified, and he did all these wonderful things. And I still say, I'm sorry, but excessive wealth leads to excessive power. And even in the best hands, as we've seen for thousands of years, bad things happen. And so I don't differentiate between them. I just look and see, do they have excessive wealth? If they have wealth above that, we should limit it.
Chad from Greenfield, say hello to Scott. What is your question or comment?
Well, real quick, just a case study, kind of what the other caller says. You know, Maggie, you bring up Ron Johnson, but what about Barack Obama? They got a $65 million book front, and they got three houses that are worth over $10 million. Michelle gets on the stage and says her parents don't trust people that take more than they deserve, yet they're worth $85 million. Do they have excessive wealth disorder? Do you not trust them? And are they a threat to democracy and the economy, like you're saying, capitalism, like you're saying?
I'll just take a first stab at this, because I don't want to put any words in Scott's mouth. When Barack Obama and Michelle Obama rose to the White House, they didn't have that. Okay. One of my concerns is rich people buying elections because they can self-fund campaigns to a nearly unlimited amount. First. Second thing, I want to believe that we can do better with our tax and economic policy. And I think Barack and Michelle Obama stand for that. I am suspicious, as Scott is, with anyone with that much in their bank accounts. Scott, your response to Chad from Greenfield. Thanks, Chad.
Yeah, I mean, I think the main thing I would add would be, absolutely, if you've got 70 million, and that's over 30 million. So I would say, okay, we need to look at 50% taxes on that part. But this is where I come back to the other part of excessive wealth disorder. Let's talk about the person who's got $100,000 million. If I mean, if we're concerned about Barack Obama having 70, what about the guy who's got 100,000 million? Aren't we much more worried about him? Elon Musk has $245,000 million. Let's work on the big pieces first and then address the others.
Scale matters. The more you got, the more absolutely corrupting it is. Scott Ellis, thank you so very much. Check it out, folks. It is The Excessive Wealth Disorder. You can find about more about it at excessivewealth.org. I'm Maggie Dawn. As I say every day, I'll stand up for you. I hope you stand up for me. But it is always better when we stand together. The Devil's Advocates are next here on the Civic Media Radio Network.